So you remember we left off and finished up with chapter 2, where that long list of exiles who returned. And when you look at the end of the chapter, you find out that it's close to 50,000 people that went back. So I was actually studying in Ezra today, working ahead a little bit. And the second wave that's going to go back is going to be much smaller, much, much smaller than the first. So it was nearly 50,000 that went back, and very meager supplies that they had as well. So remember, they're leaving. It was Babylonian captivity, and they still kind of call it Babylonia, but it's under the reign of the Persians. And so Cyrus has commissioned them to go back, Zerubbabel, who is a civil leader, and Joshua, who is the high priest, to go back to rebuild the temple and to reinstitute the worship of God. And while they're doing that, they are to pray for the health of the king and for his sons. And they go back with very feeble supplies, and you kind of see the summation there in verse 64 of verse 2, 42,000 people. With a handful of others. 5,000 minas of silver, 61,000 derricks of gold. That's not much. Remember, Solomon's temple was a great temple, much silver, much gold. It was said during the reign of Solomon that silver was as plentiful as stone. That's how prosperous that he made the nation. And so he just poured a tremendous amount of precious resources into the building of the temple. And they're going back, and this is going to have an impact when we get to chapter 3, when they lay the foundation of the temple, you're going to see that not everyone is impressed with what's going on, and that's because this temple was going to be meager in contrast to the one of Solomon's day. So let's read in Ezra chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. Robert, would you mind reading from the back for us, Ezra 3, 1 through 7, please? Sir. So the seventh month, that is one of the most important months for the Jews. It's the beginning of their calendar year. Corresponds to our September, October. So this is 3 months after the arrival of the exiles. All of this is starting to take place. They're getting there. They get settled. About 3 months later, as I said, this is one of the most sacred months of the Jewish year. The first day was the Feast of Trumpets, and that was a holy day in which no work was done, and there were food offerings that were given to the Lord. 10 days later was perhaps the single most important day for the Jews, and that was the Day of Atonement. Okay, and that's the day whenever the high priest, when the temple was standing and the Ark of the Covenant was there, he would go into the most holy place and he would sprinkle blood on the Ark of the Covenant, on the mercy seat, and the sins of the people would be rolled back for the year. So that was 10 days after the Feast of Trumpets. And shortly after that, there was another important feast. That was the Feast of the Tabernacles. And the Feast of the Tabernacles was sometimes referred to as the Feast of Booths. That's where the children of Israel would go outside and build these temporary shelters. And they would dwell in those temporary shelters. And the purpose of that was to remind them of how God cared for them during the 40 years of wilderness wandering. So that was to help them commemorate God's care during that period of time before he gave them the land of Canaan. So it's at this time that all the children of Israel gather together as one man to Jerusalem. Joshua is the religious leader. Zerubbabel is the civic leader, and the plan, they plan, and first thing they do is they rebuild the altar of God. Now, that's probably the single most important piece next to the Ark of the Covenant, the single most frequently used piece that was exercised in temple worship under the Mosaic Law. So it carried great spiritual significance. This is where God would meet man. This is where the daily offerings, as we read about, were performed. There'd be an offering in the morning, an offering in the evening, sacrifices for sin for all of the people. If someone had a sacrifice that they wanted to offer or needed to offer, this is where the offering would be given on the burnt offering. And having this would allow them to at least minimally celebrate the holy days that were coming up. So you can imagine why they expedited this particular task, so they would be able to celebrate the holy days that were on the horizon. So understand that what lies before these exiles is a tremendous job. And you think about that. Sometimes you look at your life, maybe it's just me, I doubt it. I think it's probably just Christian nature. You look at your life and you realize, man, I've just got so far to go. There's so much growth that needs to be done. And if you kind of take a step back and look at it, you just realize this seems daunting. This seems overwhelming. Undoubtedly, we probably feel somewhat like they do. Like, this is just more than I can handle. How do you do a job like that? Well, you do it the same way they do. Just one thing at a time. Okay, they looked and they realized this is essential for us. This is most important, and they kind of prioritized. So they take and they build the altar, and they put it in the same spot where the bronze altar would have been previously. So they want to make sure to get it in the right location. So it's just one step at a time, and that's the way that Christian growth occurs. It's a slow process. And I was talking to Whitney the other day, and it's hard. It's like seeing a child. When you have a child and you're watching them grow and you see them day in, day out, they just don't seem to grow at all. But for somebody who hasn't seen that child for a few years, they realize, wow, the growth that has taken place since I last saw them was tremendous. You may not see much growth when you look back at last week or maybe even a month ago or a year ago. Look back 10 years, though, in your life and see if there's any spiritual growth. There should be. It should be recognizable because you're looking at a great period of time, and many small steps were taken in those 10 years to bring you to the point where you are in your faith, this level of maturity that you're at right now. And so it's daunting to look at your life and say, I got all these things that I need to work on. The way you deal with that and approach that is just one day at a time, one small task at a time. That's kind of the approach that they took with the temple. They started off by rebuilding the bronze altar. And he remarks here that although the altar had been made, the foundation of the temple had not yet been laid. So remember, Cyrus kind of issued them a grant, and he tells the administrators who are under his jurisdiction where they've gone. It's referred to as beyond the river, and you're going to see that term popping up in Ezra and Nehemiah frequently, simply talking about on the other side of the Euphrates River. So the capital of Persia would have been located far, far, far off to the east. So beyond the river is just a reference to the province that's on the other side of the Euphrates as you make your way west, and that's where Jerusalem and Judea and the various places where the Jews would have lived is at. So he issues this edict and says, you give them whatever aid they need. And he kind of set a limit on what that was. So what they do is they take advantage of that, and they send for some of the cedar trees from Lebanon. These were the same place that Solomon got some of the great trees in which he used for building his temple as well. They send from Lebanon. From Joppa, that would have been a 35-mile transport to Jerusalem. So you can imagine the daunting task of then trying to move those huge logs all the way from Joppa to Jerusalem. But those were necessary for building the foundations of the wall and for the foundations of the temple as well. So they're making some small steps of progress, but as this fear was on them, the presence is soon going to be noticed. And as we're going to see in chapter 4, there's soon going to be some opposition that arises. So they're kind of making some waves as they're reinstituting the temple, and their presence is going to be made known to others. So they're somewhat fearful. How are we going to be accepted? How are the outsiders going to treat us? Are we going to face any resistance? And the answer to that is yes, there's going to be opposition rise up to the work. So they set the altar in place where the old one would have been. They set the new one up in the same place that was essential for them. And we understand how the altar is essential for us in a sense. It's not the altar that was used where the sacrifices were slain, but what the altar was pointing toward was the cross, where Jesus would give his life, and he would serve as a sacrifice for sin for all of those who would believe. And so we understand the significance of that in a greater sense. And undoubtedly, they would have celebrated the Feast of the Tabernacles. So they would have remembered God's providential care for them and Wouldn't that be an important lesson for them as they're undertaking this great task and there's going to be opposition that rises up to withstand them? To remember, God took care of us then, and God's going to take care of us now. So let's look ahead in Ezra 3. Dad, would you read for us verses 8 through 13, the rest of the chapter, please?
Come out of captivity to Jerusalem, begin to work, and appoint the Levites from 20 years old and above to oversee the work of the house of the Lord. And Jeshua and his sons and brothers, Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, arose as one to oversee the working of the house of God. The sons of Henadad were their sons and their brethren the Levites. When the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests filled their apparel. And they sang responsibly, praising and giving thanks to the Lord. For he is good, for his mercy endures toward Israel. Then all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and heads of the fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this temple was laid before their eyes. Yet many shouted and loud for joy, so the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy and the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard far off.
All right, so it's the second year, and they finally get the foundation for the temple built. And so they decide to do what's called a dedication, okay, to celebrate, to give thanks to God for the progress that's been made. Obviously, the foundation would be required before they can bring the temple to completion. So Joshua has the various Levites and the priests come with their various instruments that David had designed and that was used in the worship of God under the temple dispensation. And the people gather together and they're praising God. They're singing the Psalms of David. They're playing their instruments. They're worshiping God. And somewhat of a mixed reaction from the crowd. Now, you would think that this would be a very joyous moment. And for some of them, it was. Remember, they've been in Babylon for 70 years. And so the majority of people that were here would be those who had once lived in Babylon. They'd never been able to worship God under in Jerusalem with the temple. They never would have been able to participate in the sacrifices, celebrate those holy days there. And so this was a tremendous thing for them. They're shouting with joy. But if you think about it, there would have been some very, very old people who would have seen Solomon's temple before they were taken captive. They would have saw it in all of its grandeur, in all of its splendor, in all of its glory. And as I said, Solomon's temple was significantly larger, significantly greater, significantly more beautiful in terms of physically appealing. And so when they saw this small, measly temple, by comparison, the foundation that had been laid, those who had once saw Solomon's temple in all of its glory, they're crying because this seems insignificant compared to the glory of the temple past. So as they come together, those who never worshiped God in the temple were rejoicing, and those who'd seen Solomon's temple were just crying out in sorrow. And so there's a danger in this weeping, though, if you think about it. And you think, well, that maybe that's an appropriate response, but there's a danger in that whenever you have this tendency to look back at what we call the good old days. And sometimes we do that, don't we? We look back, especially maybe when it comes to the work that we're doing and the work that the church is involved in today. And you look back to the way things were done, I don't know, 50 years ago, 60, 70 years ago, tent meetings and baptisms by the dozens, two-week-long events. And you kind of look at how maybe in your mind things have digressed to a point where there's not as much interest in spiritual things and the growth isn't as exponential as it once was. There's this tendency to kind of look back at the way things were and just bemoan where we are and the progress that the church is making today. And there's that danger where if you live in that mentality of the good old days, then you will miss the present work that's going on, and you may discourage those who are engaged in that present work. And so we need to heed the warning that's issued here. Remember, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah were speaking to the people during these times. They're going to really encourage them to progress in building. And the older generation, here's kind of a rebuke toward them from the prophet Zechariah. Now, I don't know if this was directly spoken to them. However, it certainly applies to them as they're looking at the temple and it's small in size and they're crying out in sorrow. It says, the hand of Zerubbabel has laid the foundation of this house. His hand shall also complete it. So he's foretelling what started is going to be accomplished. Then you will know that the Lord of hosts has sent me to you. For whoever has despised the day of small things shall rejoice and shall see the plumb line in the hands of Zerubbabel. So, and that's essentially this older generation, as they're crying out in sorrow, that's what they're doing. They're despising the day of small things. Yes, physically, in the eyes of the people, it was seemingly insignificant. However, he warns, don't have that attitude. It may seem small, but this is done at the behest and at the hand of God. And just hold where you're at real quick in Ezra. We're going to go ahead and move to chapter 4 here in just a moment. Flip to Haggai real quick. It's close to the end of your Bible. The prophet Haggai, it's a little two-chapter book, I think. So you've got Malachi, Zechariah, and Haggai. Look at Haggai chapter 2, and you see him offering a similar warning as well. And these seem to be words that were spoken whenever this happened, whenever the people were discouraged by the smallness of the new temple that was being built. Haggai 2, look at verses 1 through 5. In the seventh month, on the 21st day of the month, the word of the Lord came by the hand of Haggai the prophet. Speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, so this is a word given to them, and to all the remnant of the people, and say, who is left among you who saw this house in its former glory? How do you see it now? Is it not as nothing in your eyes? Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, declares the Lord. Be strong, O Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the high priest. Be strong, all of you people of the land, declares the Lord. Work, for I am with you, declares the Lord of hosts, according to the covenant that I made with you when you came out of Egypt. My spirit remains in your midst. Fear not. So he says, don't be discouraged by what seems to be small to you. I'm still with you. My spirit's with you. I'm commissioning this. I'm going to bring it to completion. And so he tells them, don't be discouraged. Don't be looking backward. Move forward. Okay, and so that's the word to them of encouragement. And often it's that way in the church where those who are older and have witnessed things done differently, perhaps they weep because things aren't the same way that they once were. And while those who are younger are often excited and thankful to be part of something that's fresh. So we need to not look backward. We need to be looking toward the future. And we need to find encouragement here in the lesson we see, the rebuke from the prophets to those who were discouraged that things weren't the way that they once were in times of old. Any comments on chapter 3 before we go on? Okay, I guess we can go back.
It's really wonderful, the wisdom God used in putting his word together for us to learn. There's a very obscure character mentioned in chapter 2, verse 41, a man by the name of Barzillai the Gileadite. We're talking about his descendants, for those who don't know who this was, he was an old man that assisted David when he was fleeing from Absalom.
Mm-hmm.
And the point I want to make out of this is we see the faithfulness of this man passed down from generation to generation to generation, even through the Babylonian captivity. His descendants are still faithful to the Lord and the influence that he had on those who come after him.
That's a good observation, because, I mean, how long ago did David live? This would have been literally hundreds of years, probably 500 years post-David, and yet these descendants of this man Barzillai are still faithful to the Lord. They're part of that faithful remnant that's been brought home. Real good observation, and I think that's a good word of encouragement for all of us, you know, to invest in our children, invest in our progeny, because it may be that our faithfulness is perpetuated through the generations for who knows how long. Good point. Anybody else on chapter 3?
Yeah.
Yes, John?
Talking about the work ethics of the people. And the one
the verse in Nehemiah that we talked about when they're building the wall, but I think it also applies here that the people had a mind to work.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that even today that applies, a thing that we try to accomplish. That's what we do.
Yeah.
If we've got the mind to do it, we can God be with us.
That's a good point. So it requires both of these things. We're not just working in our own power, right? But we've got to have the mind to work. But if we've got the mind to work, then it's as Haggai said, work for the Lord is with you, right? So both of those things come together, the mind to work and the power of God working in us.
And when those two things meet, then great things are done. Though they may not be great in the eyes of man, they're great in the sight of God. And that's who we're ultimately seeking to please. All right, let's get into chapter 4, the first six verses. Dick, you want to read that for us? Let me see. I don't think we have any. Yeah, I don't think there's any terrible names in here. If you do, we are going to come across some names, so if you don't want to be a part of that, just say I'll pass. If I call on you and you don't want to read. Ezra 4, 1 through 6, please.
Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple unto the Lord, God of Israel, then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said unto them, let us build with you, for we seek your God as ye do, and we do sacrifice unto him since the days of Ezrahadon, king of Asher, which brought us up hither. But Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the chief of the fathers of Israel said unto them, ye have nothing to do with us to build an house unto to our God, but we ourselves together will build unto the God of Israel, as King Cyrus, the king of the Persia, hath commanded us. I mean, six.
Please.
Then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building, and hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose. All the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they unto him an acquisition against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem.
All right, thank you. So here we see this opposition beginning to rise up. They are the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin. They aren't adversaries yet, but they're quickly going to become that as we see how the refugees treat them when they come and offer their help. So remember, when the kingdom was divided after the days of Solomon, broken into two parts, two tribes, Judah and Benjamin in the south, that was collectively called Judah, and the ten tribes in the north that were called Israel. Northern tribes, Israel, was taken captive by the Assyrians a couple of 150 years before the Jews were taken captive by the Babylonians. So during that time, they just were really dispersed among the foreign nations, and Israel never becomes a nation again. The ten tribes are dispersed, and they never regain their unity again. And the product of the intermarriage is with the Assyrians is a group of people we know very well in the New Testament called the Samaritans. Okay, we actually meet the Samaritans before we get to the New Testament. We meet them here in Ezra chapter 4. Okay, they're the ones that are coming up and that are offering to help be a part of this rebuilding temple project. So naturally, being part Israelite, they want to help. They think, we've got a stake in this. We're part Israelite. And they make this interesting statement. They say, we worship God as you do, or we seek God as you do. And so they say, we've been worshiping God while y'all were off in captivity. We've been worshiping the Lord. And when they say the Lord, they're talking about Yahweh, the God of Israel. So since we were brought here by the Assyrians, we've continued to worship God. We've been sacrificing. And we've been doing the things that God has called us to do. They say we seek God as you do, or we worship God as you do, but that's not true. They're trying to come in under the guise that they've worshiped God the same way that the Jews are going to worship God. And as I said, that's not a true statement. They're kind of being deceitful in what they're saying. One, they didn't worship at the place. Remember, God says, you're going to worship me where I set my name. Okay? And God has set his name in Jerusalem. And the temple was to be the place where they were to worship God. However, they didn't worship at the temple. They worshiped at a different place. Not only that, but they worshiped without a priesthood. Okay, so remember, it's the priests and it's the those from the tribe of Levi, from the lineage of Aaron, that were to be the ones who were to guide that. So their statement, "We worship God as you do," contradicted their claim when you look at how they worship God. And Zerubbabel, Joshua, and the other leaders denied the request, saying, "You don't have anything to do with us in the rebuilding of the temple." They might kind of mean by that, Cyrus has commissioned us and he's given us this job, so it's really our responsibility, not yours. I don't think that's what he means, though. I think that he realizes what they're trying to do, and he doesn't want them to have any part with it. And here's why that is. When you back up to 2 Kings chapter 17, there's a group of people, and this is them that's referred to here. It says, they feared the Lord. These people who are coming and asking, we want in on the temple project. It says they feared the Lord, but they also served their own gods after the manner of the nations from among who they'd been carried away. So here's the deal. They worshiped Yahweh, but they didn't worship Yahweh exclusively. They didn't worship God in the manner that he had prescribed. So it's this more than their bloodline. You may say, well, he's rejecting them because they're half-breeds. They're only half Israelites. They're mixed with Assyrian blood. That's not so much the reason for the rejection. This is a spiritual rejection. It's because they did not worship God as he commanded. It's because they did not worship God alone. And so a point for us in this is you don't worship God unless you worship God exclusively. These people didn't worship God exclusively. They had other gods. They broke the first two commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall make for yourself no graven images. And so they tried to hold on to part of the heritage of old, but they also incorporated some of the new from the Assyrians and their false gods that they had brought in. As you look kind of at Israel's history, just track that even prior to the captivity, historical alliances, political alliances with foreigners would lead the people into idolatry. And this is the very thing that caused them to be taken into captivity. And so there's this great temptation to say, you know what, we're weak, we're small, we could use more help, we could use more resources. But there's a danger in that when you lean on the arm of the flesh, because that would have planted seeds that could have possibly grown to corruption. And as we're going to see when we get to the second part of the book of Ezra, chapter 7 through 10, there are seeds of idolatry planted through intermarriage that are beginning to grow, even in the short period of time after God has released the people. So by welcoming them, by allowing them to help in this building project, it would have been somewhat traitorous in regard and would have compromised their spiritual purity by allowing the Samaritans to help them. So it's not because of the impurity of their blood, but it's because of the impurity of their faith. That's the reason for the rejection. Dick?
Also, it's probably not as important as that, but the Cyrus, they have an agreement with Cyrus. Mm-hmm. Cyrus told them, you can go build the temple.
Yeah, yeah. So and I think that they may be kind of alluding to that. They're politely declining. Cyrus has given his job to us, and so we don't really need to bring anyone else in. But I think it's more so, at least it's masking the real reason for their rejection, and that's because spiritually they're impure, and they didn't want to mingle with that. Robert?
I think they were probably looking for a tactical advantage as well. You're not clearly giving them the resources that they need for restoring this nation. If they did it in favor of God, that would give them an advantage.
They did worship God, but they worship God and a whole bunch of others. And so they thought, if we can get in on this, this will be a pretty good deal. We'll be able to capture some blessings, right, by worshiping God at the temple. So, yeah, their reasons for wanting to help are not out of it's self-interest. It's motivated by self-interest and a desire to kind of get in there with the legitimate worship of God, while at the same time holding on to all of the other false religions that they practice. Dad?
Syria overthrew the Northern Kingdom and exiled all the Jews out of there. They brought in people from other lands that haven't taken the land. God sent the lions in amongst them. And they become so terrified of the lions, they appealed to the king and said,
yeah,
bring some of these Jews back and let them teach us their ways for their God to take these lions away from them.
Yeah.
So this is probably some of the descendants
of
those people that just enough about God, period.
Yeah.
Not enough to serve the way you want.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was historically the problem that Israel had. You don't see them really, a couple of times, you don't see them completely ceasing to worship God, but you see this syncretism kind of creep in, where they worship God and they incorporate the worship of Baal and the worship of Asherah. So it's the same danger that led Israel into captivity. That is the refusal to worship God alone. And that's why he gave the first commandment. You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. And so after realizing that they're not going to be able to assist in the project, they begin to discourage the people. And we're going to see how they use some political persuasion later on in chapter 4 to really halt the work, for as we're going to see a significant period of time. So we'll pick up in the second part of chapter 4 next week.